Welcome to the Bungie Line. I'm Ted Hager.
And I'm Alex Barnett.
And Alex, guess what?
What's that?
We got our first email. A listener sent in an email to us, and you know, as new podcasts go and
exciting
everything, it's
times.
Always great to get the first email.
A magic moment.
Yes. This one says, it's actually, the name is Ima Fakir, and the person's in Durban, South Africa, if you can believe that. And it says, Dear Sirs, they have a lot of respect for us, see? Dear Sirs, I have really been enjoying your podcast. It's been a great resource for me as a developer. But why always the shtick with the didgeridoo sound every time?
Really?
Yeah.
He sounds quite upset about it.
Yeah. Well, he's liking the podcast, at least. It's complimentary about that.
What do you think? He's got a problem with just harping on about it.
Yeah, well, I mean, this time we weren't even going to have anything about the didgeridoo
sound. Well, we
agreed
that, right? We weren't even going to go there.
Yeah, because it's been every episode so far, and this time we said, let's not do the didgeridoo thing again.
Oh, well, it's too late now, isn't it?
Thanks a lot, Ima. You've managed to get the didgeridoo sound into it again this time. Coming up, we're going to be talking about OAuth, the open authentication for web APIs and various other things, with a few gentlemen who are actually on the project.
We're going to have Chris Messina, Larry Half, and Aaron Hammer, guys who have been very closely involved with the whole OAuth
specification, the actual code samples and things like that are out there already.
Evangelism, getting a community up and running, very exciting, very important work.
Let's just give a scenario here real quick, because I'm sure some of our listeners have actually dealt with some of these things. Almost everybody's done a Flickr mashup at this point, or at least I'm going to assume that they have.
My granny hasn't.
Okay, well, there you go. But if you've ever dealt with a Flickr API and just doing the authentication routine on it so that you can have authenticated access to Flickr stuff so that you can see friends lists and things like that, you've actually got to do this really weird thing. You've got a secret key from Flickr. You've got to take that, and then you've got to take all the args that you're going to put on the URL, the REST URL that you're going to send to them. You have to put them in alphabetical order. You have to remove the equal signs on it. Then you have to pass your secret key on it and an MD5 checksum of some sort on it. You have to mash these things all together just to get the URL that is the authenticated URL to make this REST API call.
And that's how they do it.
And that's how Flickr does it, not how anybody else will do it. In fact, other Yahoo resources may be using other things like BBAuth and such things as that.
Yeah, it's not just a Yahoo thing, right? It's right across the industry, multiple different ways to essentially do the same thing.
And you get out of web APIs and you get it with desktop apps are doing some things like this. There's all kinds
of messy,
different stuff.
And we need it cleaned up.
So we're going to go forward and we're going to find out right now going on with OAuth.
Hey, good morning, everybody. And today we've got some interesting guys talking about OAuth. A new project that's coming online as we speak. We have Chris Messina, Larry Half, Aaron Hammer, guys behind the OAuth. How are you guys?
Fine.
Excellent. Before we get on to the OAuth topic itself, it'd be great if you could just give a quick background on yourselves and who you are and how you came to this project. Just keep it short and sweet, and we'll be able to dive into the details later. Kick off with you, Chris.
Sure. So I'm Chris Messina. I co-run Citizen Agency in San Francisco, a small consulting company with me and my partner. I actually got involved in OAuth pretty early on because Larry in Magnolia is actually a client of ours, and I was actually trying to get OpenID to work a little better for them, and as well, I was also lobbying Twitter at the time to support OpenID, and we came upon this problem that basically turned into a solution called OAuth.
Okay. Larry?
Yep. I'm Larry Health. I'm the founder of Magnolia. It's a social bookmarking service, and December of last year, we opened ourselves up as an OpenID consumer, which meant that people could create their accounts with an OpenID. However, this presents a problem with accessing our API since we no longer hold their credentials for their account. Our members with OpenID weren't able to use applications that required API access. Well, they could, but it wasn't really the best user experience. So we were set about looking to find a solution for what's called delegated authentication, when you sort of take the actual login process out of it.
Okay, thanks. And Aaron?
I'm Aaron Hammer. I am the founder and sole employee of Universe. The product I'm working on is a microblogging tool focused on corporate consumers and back-end technology. So it's basically if a large bank wants to have their own in-house Twitter service, that will be a service they'll be able to use. And I was, as I was working on it, my main focus was on the server side and building the whole user experience on top of API. So taking the approach of basically only having an API, and then every user experience is coming through an API consumer. And when you do that, you very quickly realize that you need some way of making that API secure and verifiable. So I started inventing my own facility, and I went on the OpenID list, and I was just offering some suggestions. John Panzer said, "Hey, we know we are working on this OAuth project over here. Why not join us?" So that's how I ended up in OAuth.
So it sounds like from all three of your introductions, there's a common theme here. You each had a need with APIs, and you all, I think, mentioned also the idea of OpenID. Maybe, Chris, maybe you could give us a quick overview of what OAuth is all about. And if you would, maybe start it with, why isn't OpenID enough?
Certainly. So I think that the OpenID connection is one of the more interesting drivers and aspects of how OAuth came to be. And it also turns out later on to be pretty interesting in terms of how we designed the protocol and certain decisions that we made along the way. So again, to go back to give a little more, I guess, detail to the needs that I found in advocating OpenID with Magnolia and Twitter. First, you know, my first experience with having an OpenID for Magnolia, which I was able to log in and so on, and also realizing that people could literally create brand new accounts on Magnolia with an OpenID. So literally they had no username and password. It was when, you know, I downloaded a dashboard widget for dashboard and tried to actually use it, and I found that, well, all these dashboard widgets actually required a username and password to log in. And this was my first kind of like, aha, it's like, well, I could put my OpenID into this dashboard widget, but that's not going to work. So how do we solve that problem? The second came, again, through Twitter, where they've been very proactive in supporting open standards and open formats. For example, I advocated that they add support for microformats on their site, and so now they do. And I wanted, similarly, for them to support OpenID, and suddenly they came to a sort of halting realization that if they wanted to offer it, they needed to figure out a way to make it compatible with their API. And because their API previously was using, or well, even currently is using, usernames and passwords for authentication, it all of a sudden fell apart when we got to people using OpenID.
Now, OpenID really is just that, though. It is just sort of name, password. I've got a URL. I can authenticate against that. That will verify who I am. But it's a real binary thing. It's just a who I am. Right.
Yeah, it's all OpenID deals with, as the name implies, is identification. It's like this person who owns this URL is that person.
And then you can from there, it's a, you either grant all access or no access at that point, right?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, where you allow like single time access and so on. And all it does is it allows you to log back into the same site without having to do the username, password, song and dance. So OAuth solves a somewhat, it's related, but it's a different problem. It really deals with the problem of authorization and sort of allowing remote access to protected resources on a different service someplace. So for example, if you want to use a Twitter mashup tool, or maybe an even more simple example, let's say that you want to post something that you've just dug on Dig to your blog. Now, currently, if you want to actually take something that you've dug on Dig, it's going to be very much of a tongue twister, you have to give Dig your username and password. And that's a really sort of bad situation because what it trains people to do is to pass around their username and password, as someone said, as confetti. you know, kind of just throwing it around the web. The same thing's true, for example, when you sign up for a new social network and it asks you for your Google username and password to invite your friends. You know, you shouldn't be giving away your username and password to Gmail when it also can unlock access to your Google Checkout account. One example that I came up with that would be a really, I think, awesome sort of visual example almost of where this becomes really powerful is in the iGoogle homepage or NetVibes or PageFlakes.
Oh, yeah.
Where essentially you're bringing together, you know, 40 different services that all have data that's behind a password. And instead of giving, you know, NetVibes or whomever 40 different sets of passwords, instead you basically are able to go through and either through having a really smart identity provider or by clicking a link in each of the widgets and then doing the remote authentication. It kind of gives you a sense for, okay, it makes sense because all of a sudden you have this external site that literally is being, you know, is a mashup of countless services and the power that they have over your data if they have your native username and password is huge. Anyways, so we started talking about those problems. Kellen from Flickr, Larry from Magnolia, Blaine from Twitter, who can't join us right now, and we started looking at, you know, what can we do? And so, you know, rather than trying to just reinvent the wheel and come up with our own authentication system, we were actually at Foo Camp. But we were like, well, there's all these authentication protocols that do this already. And those protocols are Google Auth Sub, Yahoo's BB Auth, Flickr's Flickr Auth, Facebook Auth, AOL's Open Auth. There's a whole slew of them. And they all essentially do the same thing, which is to allow you delegated access to your resources. But they all use slightly different protocols, slightly different parameter names, and the whole deal.
And a lot of them are convoluted. I mean, it's, you've got to do a lot of work to decipher what it is that they're actually, the pattern that they're trying to get across.
That's correct. And, you know, part of it is, you know, these folks needed to solve their own problem for their own context and their own circumstance at a certain time, and they had certain needs to take care of. You know, so kind of, you know, makes sense to some degree, but it's becoming much more of a widespread problem for web services. Because they need access to all kinds of different data to make their systems run, but the means so far is either through public data via either microformats or RSS or Atom subscriptions, or you have to go through authentication, and again, providing your username and password for these services. And as a lot of people do tend to use the same username and password for all their different services, it becomes kind of a nightmare, both to maintain sort of the integrity of your credentials. You know, once it's compromised for all these different places. And as well, simply being able to maintain access, being able to revoke privileges that you've given out is something that's super useful and super important. And you can see this through the permissions aspect of Flickr. So if you give, for example, an uploader access to your account, you can then revoke it later without having to change your password and reset all the other applications that have access to your account.
But that is within the Flickr domain. I mean, you can't get
That
doesn't work outside of that, and that's part of what you guys are trying to solve, right?
That's right. So basically, you know, there were all these protocols that existed. They were all somewhat specific to each application. And so what was turning out to be the case is that if you were a developer, you literally had to implement support for every one of these protocols if you wanted to be able to pull in content or data from these remote services. And it just became a nightmare. It's like, okay, how do I maintain, you know, tokens and keys and blah, blah, blah for Google, for Yahoo, for Flickr, for Facebook, and so on and so forth? If instead we could find or extract the best practices from these protocols and make the protocol as compatible as possible and then generalize it to be useful anywhere and then offer that as an open protocol that anybody could choose to implement, we were making progress, not just for, you know, we were definitely solving our own problem, but we were also doing something that would save us a whole heck of a lot of work later on down the road, where all of a sudden web services would just be able to sort of talk in OAuth and not worry about these various protocols. And so essentially that's kind of where this all started off.
We also addressed the problem of desktop applications and mobile devices or devices with limited capabilities, if it's sets of boxes and stuff like that.
Like Chumbies or Navas tags.
Where today, if you're trying to use those devices, it gets tricky because not all the providers today can really handle a non-website talking to them. So they have all sorts of hacks around it, and OAuth actually does a very clean solution of allowing you to use the same protocol with very few variants to achieve transparency. So you can basically offer the same API to a cell phone, to a desktop application, or to another website.
Now, talk to me about the developer experience. What is it actually, what do you have to do to, A, enable your site service to be OAuth enabled? And from the other side, what do you need to do as a developer to be able to connect to that as a service and be able to run with it?
Yeah, maybe Aaron can help us with that one.
The first thing to remember that at this point, OAuth is, it's a fully operational spec, but it doesn't really provide generic interoperability or automatic discovery, which are features that have been heavily discussed in our group, and they are coming. So at this point, it's really it's a protocol that gives you a framework of how you can take a user username and password and turn it into a token that a third party can use to access those resources. So that's something to keep in mind. The protocol itself is very simple, and once you get into it, it's a few parameters that you have to pass back and forth. The easiest way of somebody to come in and say, I want to use that, I have an API and I would like to use OAuth for authentication, what they can do is go to the OAuth website and they can find a variety of languages. We have, I think, like 6 or 7 languages right now. We have libraries ready to be used. Now, those libraries are not, you know, it's not something you take out of the box and you dump it on your web server and you're done. It's something that you're going to have to manually integrate, but this will implement most of the nuts and bolts of the protocol, which includes some signature logic and some formatting of parameters. Now, generally, OAuth has 3 main steps. The first step is the consumer, which is the website, the third party who would like to do something useful for the user by accessing the user service resources on another party, which is the service provider. So I don't know if I said that clear enough, but basically you have the user, that's the guy who has his picture somewhere. You have the service provider, that's the service hosting those pictures, and then you have the consumer, that's the site that the user wants to use to print their pictures.
So a classic love triangle situation here.
Yes. I think I killed this example to death on my blog. and it's actually Jane, the lovely vacation girl, is the subject of my example. So the way it will work is before this service is offered to the user, before the printing site can offer this to the user to say, yes, we can go and grab your pictures off the photo site, they have to go and they have to read some documentation from the photo site telling them, we support OAuth. So that's nice because now they don't have to go and learn a whole new set of APIs. And they're going to say, and here are some important details about what you need to do. So this is where you connect, this is the format of what we expect, and this is the encryption or the signing algorithms we support, and so on. So that information right now is manually delivered, and the spec does not detail how you're actually going to deliver that. They also have to establish some kind of what we call a consumer key, which is a way for each consumer to identify themselves to the provider. Now, if the photo site doesn't care who are those third parties that are accessing users' photos, they just want to make sure the user are okay with it, then they can use the same consumer key for everybody. But if they want to either track it for statistics, they want to, you know, give special benefits such as cooler API, faster servers, no API throttling, like anything like that, they will need to identify that, you know, not only the user whose resources are being accessed, but also who's the consumer, who's the third party who's accessing those resources on behalf of the user. So this is all done out of band before we even start. Once this is all set up, then now the consumer knows how to interact with the service provider. This is the same case today, whether if you're going to work with Flickr or Google or AOL or many of the other sites that have a similar API. But then if you've done it for Google, you don't know how to do it for Flickr, and you don't know how to do it for anybody else. So this is where OAuth comes in. It's basically saying, if you're a new consumer, a new service provider, you can easily just pick this and support it, and you can inform the community this is what you're using. And then developers, when they're going to use a service provider, can say, oh, great, they're not, you know, we don't have to learn yet another one. We already know how OAuth works. We have some libraries that do all the heavy lifting for us, and we'll just go and work with that.
Does that kind of explain a little bit of why the service provider would actually want to implement this kind of thing, because they get more of a generic thing, people don't have to relearn or anything like that?
I mean, there is the benefit of having consumers be familiar with the protocol, so you don't have to learn something new. And, of course, one of the main reasons why Twitter API is so successful is because it's easy. It's simple to understand, and it doesn't take away from its power. So if Twitter would go and start introducing a new API that everybody has to go and really learn, you know, how to interact with it, then now it makes it much more complicated. But if it's a standard that there is a developer community behind, then it becomes much easier to do.
Okay, so there's two halves of this, right? One is the developer community and them getting bought into the technical solution, the technical elegance of the solution, the fact that it's open source, this, that, and the other. And maybe, Larry, you could talk to us a little bit about the benefits that they might perceive, but also the consumer benefits and the consumer experience.
I'll first talk about some of the service provider stuff. And I think my answer will probably be a little bit on the ideological side, if everyone will indulge me. I think we're starting to just see this happening in the world of online services, which is where people are going to be developing new web services, new websites, new applications, where they don't hold everyone's identity and the keys. That with OpenID, and I think even if you look at the way Facebook has opened up their platform, users are going to be able to choose sort of how they access your website. So the first step won't be always picking a username and password for a website. It'll be entering an identity URL or maybe another account, like entering your Facebook account and authorizing through Facebook. And so given that situation, if you then want to give users of your service access to your, well, actually to their data that you're holding for them, you can't use the typical route of providing API access with their username and password. So you really need a system in which you can provide authorization for their account without having to, you know, go through the typical login. We don't see this a whole lot right now, but I think there are a number of services that are coming out. If you look at the stuff that Janrain has been launching, I don't think either Jite or Pib have you create a username and password. They just have you enter your OpenID.
That's correct.
And I think we're going to be seeing more and more of that. So that's sort of like from the service provider side, is I think that, you know, if you're a service provider and you're looking at the future and the fact that you eventually can't be wed to the traditional username and password model, you really need something like OAuth. It's just a better experience, because when you support OAuth, all the libraries are out there and developers can code for your service and not have to worry about the authentication piece. I think Chris spoke really well to the sort of consumer end of the experience. The consumer experience will become better in that people will learn, instead of being trained to enter their username and passwords for services everywhere, they will learn that they shouldn't be entering their username and passwords. They shouldn't be entering their identity credentials on any website that then stores them, God knows how, and uses those credentials to then do stuff on their behalf without them really knowing what's going on. There'll be a bit of a learning curve in that sense, and that people are sadly now used to just being able to enter their username and password on a third-party service and have things work. But I think one of the interesting things is I think adoption of OAuth will be driven not by the consumers. It will be driven by service providers. And it's actually sort of a much easier sale on that end. I think it requires a lot less of a service provider to say, hey, we're going to support Oath for delegated authentication.
Now, you've got a community of developers that have been you've been working with in order to carve out the solution, and you're now starting to kind of socialize the idea and getting more and more people involved and getting enthused. But I think an interesting challenge that faces you guys is how you get the initial momentum and inertia. How do you bootstrap the community that you need in order to really make this into a success?
And if service providers are actually one of the key places where you think that that's going to happen, not so much the end user, it would seem in addition to the community side, you would have to start doing a pretty good recruiting effort to get the different providers out there to start grabbing onto this. If you had like a couple good size wins or something like that, it seems like you'd get some critical mass or something.
I mean, I think we have a lot of those wins sort of in the works. I mean, the spec is just out, and there's actually a lot of interesting and fair-sized people who are looking at implementing it. And I think it's like a super, super easy sale to a service provider because it's, you know, here you go. If you use this standard, this protocol, then you have, you know, you have instantly reached a bunch of developers. The developers don't have to jump through hoops just to authenticate against your service. And
well, not only that, but I mean, it's actually offering better protection in some cases to, you know, their actual users, you know, the members of their service. And I think that's really important. I think that Larry's right that it's an easy sell in that way. But, you know, one of the drivers for this was moving more towards something like OpenID. And in some ways, that's about reducing your exposure by using the same username and password all over the place. And then the second part of that is, okay, now that you have essentially allowed for certain remote parties to have access to your stuff, how do you very cleanly define access and permissions to those folks who are remote when essentially they're all using the same credentials to access your stuff? You know, what OAuth does, it's essentially kind of a stepping protocol where, and this is outside the scope of the spec, but what it allows for is to say, you know, when someone shows up with this token and this secret, they have access to this part of this person's account. So, for example, right now, again, the example that I made about Gmail, when someone gets your Gmail username and password, nothing prevents that remote site from accessing other parts of your account, for example, just your email. When in fact, all you want to do is give that remote site access to, let's say, just your contact list.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really important to realize that as more and more sites, especially like Facebook and so on, have these resources that go beyond just raw data that you could scrape off of a public website, but they do actually and are capable of exacting transactions or of, you know, having a password reset sent by email and so forth. We're going to need to have this kind of delegated protection system in place and done in a standard way so that it becomes sort of the norm where users are more and more comfortable with and familiar with the idea of logging into their specific service provider or identity provider.
I think the same reason that made some of us spend the many hours it took to create this certification, the same reason is why people, I think, will find it very useful to use it, and that it's it's not a trivial process to come up with a good API authentication algorithm. It's something that, if you look at, you know, even if you look at some of the commercial ones available from, you know, major companies, when we were talking on the group, we end up saying, "Oh, this is not very good," and they said, "Yeah, you know, we end up doing it this way because we're limited here or there." But basically, if you're a small company. And most, you know, most of the API today are coming from startups, from smaller companies that are being innovative and creating something new. They don't have the resources to go and really invest, you know, a couple of months in building this kind of protocol. So they can go and they can, you know, copy one of the more known ones, if it's Google's or Flickr, or they can default to username and passwords, but it's kind of tricky because you keep telling all your users all the time, never tell anybody your username and password. And you say, oh, but if you want to use all those cool services, then tell them your username and password.
Yeah, do exactly the opposite of what I just told you to do.
Yeah, so the so you're motivated as a service provider to go and find a way to still, you know, give APIs. And I think Twitter proved that, you know, a good API will really go a long way in improving your brand. So you want to offer it. If you want to offer it, you have to find a way of authenticating the users and granting access. And then how do you do that? And for me, that was the exact reason why I ended up spending about, you know, a month less focused on my own startup and more focused on this, because I needed it. Because I was kind of stuck in my own development saying, I need something good. And, you know, because of this effort, I personally got, you know, the eyes of some of the best minds in security and API looking at this spec and saying, this is good, this is not so good, here are some pitfalls about security. I mean, we got some people on the authors list and people who are on the group that have very impressive resumes. And they looked at it and, you know, they gave us what they thought was a good thing and a bad thing about, you know, security standpoint of it. And it's all written down. So we said, you know, this is the protocol, and anyone can adjust the security level of the implementation based on their needs. So if you're not using financial information, you're just sending pictures, you probably don't need to encrypt the pictures. But if you are, you know, this gives you a way of choosing the security level you want. So for me, which, you know, I think represent most the implementers in smaller companies, this is great, because now, you know, you have this blueprint of how to do this, and it's getting, you know, scrutinized. And if somebody figures out a weakness in this, it will be public, like any other open source standard. And then there'll be, you know, there's a community that will tell you how to fix it, and there'll be revision if needed. And then there's also a community working on giving you source code that you can use to make it work.
And then going back to the question around getting the initial inertia and the momentum going, and solving kind of the chicken and egg situation, on your site, I've seen that you have folks like Flickr, Google, and a few others that have made a commitment, at least, to say that they're interested in implementing this. Talk to me how you think that adoption needs to happen over the next 6 months to a year in order for it to become then an inevitable end conclusion rather than still just a really good idea with some people interested in it.
You know, I can speak to that a little bit, just in terms of, I guess, the work that I feel like I've done within the community, and I say community, which is still sort of like getting off the ground, but, you know, I'm not really a technical person from the standpoint of being able to implement OAuth and so on, but it's been really essential and important to me from the beginning that we have a clear goal and that we also include a lot of people in the process. And do so, though, in a way that is, I think, fairly disciplined, so that the result is something that people feel good about and that they can implement and that they start to see benefits right away. So, you know, the way that this thing got started out, it was a small, closed Google Groups mailing list, and it built out kind of gradually, where we were having kind of meetings, talking about it. You know, again, we were solving our own sort of personal issues between Twitter and Magnolia. Then we started to invite some other folks in, you know, Matt from Doppler and so forth, to the point where, I guess, John Panzer talked about it at Internet Identity World, and then we started to see it. And I think Dwight Clinton from Google had heard about it through Alex at Twitter. And eventually that sort of just sort of like started bringing in a bunch of people who were realizing the need for this stuff. In fact, some conversations that I've had about promoting OpenID with larger organizations has predicated on this problem, on the problem of delegated authentication. So I think that there all of a sudden was kind of a general realization, yeah, this is something that we actually really need, and it's kind of ridiculous that we're asking developers to reinvent the wheel or re-implement the wheel over and over again for each of our different services. Why don't we come together on something? And I think what was really important about this is the way that it started and the way that it progressed. Because since it came from the grassroots and out of the community, there really wasn't any kind of threat to the larger providers for choosing to implement it or to get involved and help support it.
Yeah.
In contrast, if this protocol had come, for example, just from Google or just from Yahoo or just from AOL or just from VeriSign or whomever, I think that each of those parties, and this has been the case to date, would have a hard time swallowing the idea of just implementing, you know, their competitor's protocol.
Right.
So what I'm hopeful about is that because of the way that we develop the protocol, and I think I just want to point out that Aaron has done a tremendous job of actually ushering it forward, being sort of the champion of the spec, you know, coming out of literally nowhere. I think that we've done a really good job of, I guess, making sure that a lot of different people's use cases are met, and that we've been able to be very clear and articulate about the different use cases and why we're designing things in a certain way. For example, at one point, some folks wanted, and this goes back to your previous question, to make OAuth just an extension to OpenID. And it was absolutely critical that the protocol that we resulted with would be compatible with Google accounts, Yahoo accounts, AOL accounts, and all the rest, as well as OpenID. And I think that that was one of the things that really makes OAuth a lot more both credible but also applicable to these various contexts.
Yeah, and the fact is that people really want you to succeed. I mean, the conversations that I've had talking about OAuth, they get the idea and they go, oh, totally, just make it happen.
Yeah.
And it's still early days. There are people I've spoken to, they haven't heard of OAuth today. I'm surprised that they hadn't, but I think they will. And my take on it is that you are actually solving a very real problem for developers. It's not a solution searching for a problem.
No, it is one of those things, though, like if you look at Salesforce.com's authorization or if you look at Flickr's, and you have to do all these different like juggling acts for each one.
It's a joke.
Yeah, but the question I want to ask you guys right now, and maybe Aaron, you can start on this one, but here's the huge, massive question, I guess, and you can take it whatever direction you want, but can people actually implement OAuth today with the spec in its current condition? Can a service provider, for instance, actually implement and have their services start using OAuth? And are there any service providers who have started to do this so that developers who use those services should start looking at the OAuth spec so they can get ready to start developing, taking advantage of it?
Certainly. I mean, it's actually already being used. And I know Twitter already have an OAuth API that they're still making sure everything there is 100%, but it's there and it's ready and people can use it. And they have a very involved development community that as soon as they really discover it, they'll be all over it. It's ready. It's basically in its current form, except for like a few typos and one new paragraph. What you're seeing today is the final spec. It's been out for a couple of weeks now and we've seen absolutely no problems with it, except for some minor language clarification. So I think it's there. Now, in terms of, you know, I'm actually going to answer your question a little bit related to the previous one, is that I think what's key here is, unlike OpenID, which OpenID requires users to buy into it, ideally you will never even know that the services you're using are based on OAuth. The user interface is going to be so smooth that it will just work, and you say, oh, this is really nice. I didn't ask for my username and password.
It's only interesting to the developer, so the developer is the only person that sees it, is what you're saying then?
Yes. It's really the only person who needs to be really interested in it is the service provider. Someone's saying, I have the resources, I have the user stuff that I need to protect, and I would like to let other people do cool stuff with it on behalf of the user. And to do that, I'm going to use OAuth. Now, you have two, you know, the world split into two. You have everybody who already has an API and whatever they use to authenticate it, and those who really want to have one but don't have it yet. It's hard for me to imagine somebody who knows about OAuth, and hopefully, you know, we'll get the word out, who will come and say, oh, you know what? Nah, I want to do a brand new one just for the fun of it. Like, why? It's also a lot of work, and it's expensive. So if you need it and you don't have it now, then here is a solution for you. If you already have it, then hopefully we'll see some change coming from the big guys. I mean, you know, Google having their super secret November 5th announcement about some new API. I don't know. I'm hoping they're going to come and say, and you know what? We're going to top all that off. We're going to use OAuth as the way you're going to be using this API. They have, you know, they have their own extensive API right now, authentication layer on their API, and which is very close. So it's there and it's ready. And I don't think it's going to be as hard to sell as OpenID, because OpenID, you have to sell it to every single person in the world who's using the internet.
Right.
But with this, you have to sell it to the very few companies that offer services, and they're measured in the thousands, not in the millions.
Yep.
And Larry, are you already on track on implementing this with Magnolia?
Yeah, we are actually...
Maybe spell out the scenario a little bit, if you would. Exactly what does it mean to Magnolia to be putting OAuth into it?
Well, it means a couple of things. We're looking at being both a consumer and a provider. I mean, obviously, the provider stuff is a lot clearer in that we're going to be rolling out version 2 of our API. And the biggest change in version 2 of our API is you will have to authenticate using Oath. And that's happening in a matter of days, not weeks. I mean, I can't say exactly which day, but it'll be very soon.
It's not November 5th, super secret, is it?
Right.
It'll be November 4th to cut off Google.
Take that. There goes your announcement.
it'll be long before November 4th. But we'll be putting out the alpha or beta, or sort of the floating the balloon of our 2.0 of the API, and letting people start building their applications for us using Oath. On the other side is we do things where we consume other API services, like one of the things we do is daily blog posting, and I don't know how fast all this will happen, but sort of the sooner that blogging platforms all start implementing Oath, the better for us, because then we don't have to hold on to users' credentials in order for them to allow us to make posts to their blogs.
I mean, the more I hear about it, the fewer and fewer downsides I can possibly see on this. Here's the question then. What are the biggest points of resistance do you think that exist to this project succeeding?
Existing code. Is it?
Larry means OAuth, by the way.
Oh, the question on my mind was...
No, I think there's a lot of code out there of people either doing this the wrong way, like we have had to do with Magnolia in terms of storing credentials. That's working code for us. It works. You know, our members are happy for the most part with how that works. And then there's also the fact that, you know, Yahoo and Flickr and Google have working code for their authentication systems, and you know, they have a bunch of developers who coded to those.
And they're wedded, they're emotionally locked in, and...
I don't know if they're emotionally locked in, but, you know, is it...
Is the juice worth the squeeze to actually move over to the new thing, right? It's that old question of where developers... You have to have enough outside developers saying, fix your API, use OAuth, instead of using that silly routine that you're using currently.
Yes.
That's the kind of pressure it's going to take probably to get a lot of organizations who are already...
Now, the $6 million question in all of this, of course, is have you landed on a logo choice yet?
We seem to have a de facto one in play, right, Chris?
Yeah, you know, so, I mean, this has been going on for a while, and it's kind of been, you know, again, my side project on this. And I have a sort of a split personality where I'm all about sort of being open and democratic and so on, but there's also a side of me that comes from a school of design that realizes that in some things you just kind of need to have a clear vision and just go with it, and that's sort of been the experience of the OpenID, or I'm sorry, the OAuth logo. So in any case, I think that we are going to use something like the token that I did because it's kind of clever and cute, but also because, you know, it does scale down somewhat well. And actually, I have 5 or 6 designers who I've been asking and begging to, like, throw in a little work. And one of them I know is actually doing some more work now on it. So hopefully by November 1st, which is when we hope to have the final spec out, we will also have a final logo.
Decisions have to be made on this. You're going to have to stamp down on it, Chris, and move on.
I'm,
yeah.
I'm fully in support of the idea of just dictating which one it is on certain things. And when it comes to logos, that is not a democratic process.
Yeah, exactly.
Come on, we all know that the best logos are designed by committee.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And so here's my bet, Ted, is that in a year, 12 months down the line, I think if we spoke to these guys again, I think they'd give us a great success story. I think that would see a lot of developers' lives made easier through the adoption of buy services. It's much needed. We need to get this solved as an industry. And I think you guys are absolutely on the right path to do it. We'd like to thank you very much for your time today. We wish you the best of luck. And hopefully we can speak again with a great success story behind you in a few months.
Absolutely. Chris, absolutely. Aaron, Larry, thanks very much, guys.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you.
Now, you know, Alex, through the interview on that one, as it warms up and gets more and more intense as we go through it there, it actually was kind of interesting in the post-interview as well. We talked to the guys for a little while after we had said thanks to them, and then a couple other things came out. We should probably put those in the episode. What do you think?
Yup.
All right. Here comes a couple of quick little excerpts from our discussion with the guys after we actually thanked them and said goodbye.
One other quick idea that I had, and I put this in the IRC room, was just that, you know, in terms of, again, I mean, as more and more services rely on external data, the less that you have to provide support for people who forget their remote username and password, the better. You know, so basically we're moving the point of failure to the service provider. So if they can't log in to, let's say, Google because they forgot their username and password, instead of asking you, the consumer in that case, you know, what's my password, and you not being able to answer them, they're now asking from the proper place.
And along with that is people can change their passwords without breaking all the stuff they have set up with their API. So you can, since, you know, consumers have this token that they're using to access your stuff, somebody can change their password as many times as they want. And all of the other applications that they've authorized access to their account don't break because of that. They continue working.
Right, because right now it's like a house of cards. Whenever you change your password, everything that was using that password and passing it over there, it just all collapses on you, and you have to go back in, and every one of those services you have to re-authenticate.
Exactly.
It recaches your password.
It's a sham.
Yeah. One other question I wanted to ask you guys, just for my own edification on this one. So it sounds like you've got a little bit of an escrow thing capable in this as well, where you can deauthorize things quite easily. And that's always been a big one with identities online is, you know, once somebody has my email address or whatever, they can spam me whatever the way they want. But in the case of APIs, blocking access is always nice once somebody starts to abuse use in some way or another, or throttling them or whatever.
That's good for both service providers and consumers. The service provider can, you know, cut off wholesale access to an application. You know, if there's something out there that's obviously abusing the service, they can just cut off that consumer entirely. And then also for an end user, I mean, it's good for them. They can say, well, I don't like the way this, you know, I wish Magnolia would stop putting up those stupid daily links blog posts and just turn off access, revoke that token.
Hmm.
It's also why, you know, people have been calling OAuth kind of like the valet key for the web. You know, it's giving people a kind of protracted access or ability to act as though they're you, but that you can log what they're doing, you know, which is really awesome. So you could actually do rollbacks on certain actions. And, again, being able to just revoke tokens is awesome. Even, like, single-use tokens. One of the things that I've been thinking about is how you could actually... So one of the things that I think is actually turning out to be really, really brilliant about the protocol is that we left out how you get your access or how you exchange the token. So one of the things that I've been thinking about is how you could actually use OAuth as kind of a payment system. So instead of logging in via OpenID or via a username and password on the remote site, instead you pay. So you go to, you click like an OAuth link, it takes you to a remote site, and instead of logging in, you pay with PayPal or credit card or something, you receive a token, and then it unleashes or reveals or unlocks certain functionality. So this could also be used for serial numbers and applications.
Wow.
Here's a scenario. How does OAuth help? Mobile phones are storing a lot of these username passwords locally on their phones, right, in order to be able to now get access into email and this, that, and the other. I know that a lot of people probably don't add the PIN to the front of their phone before they are able to get access into it. How could OAuth help secure that scenario where I've lost my phone and I'm thinking, oh, no?
I'm not sure it can help in that case. I had a blog post where I was making fun of some people post that they're trying to say, oh, you know, OAuth can solve this and this and this and this and this. And I said, well, this is what it's going to look like if the DMV will try to use OAuth. And there's actually a cartoon there that shows what it's going to look like. But a key thing to remember about OAuth is that you need this triangle. You need the consumer, you need the service provider, and you need the user. And if you don't have that triangle, then it's not necessarily the right protocol for you. Now, you might take some, you know, good lessons from it, or you might take pieces of it.
Yeah.
But it's not really what it's targeted at. So if it's the scenario you talked about is really where you have the user and the service provider, and you just want to, you know, keep something less powerful than a password.
Okay.
You can adapt it, but it's not really what it's designed for.
I don't know. I mean, it could be useful for that, though. I mean, one of the things that I think is most interesting about that example is that if, for example, I've given my phone access to my Gmail account and it's accessing my Gmail using, you know, again, a token and secret, and my phone gets compromised and I lose it, I could actually log into my Gmail account elsewhere and revoke that token.
You can also change your password, though, because if everybody is using, I mean, in this particular case, you can just change your password because you're not giving it to anybody else but yourself.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess what I'm saying is that, you know, the token that you access your Gmail with on your phone could be a token that's restricted that doesn't allow you to change the password or doesn't allow you to get into certain account credentials. For example, on my iPhone, I have no ability to do anything but really download my email and send messages. So I don't need a token that allows me to go in and do all kinds of other stuff on my account because the phone doesn't even support it, you know? So, I mean, I'm wondering if there might actually be a case there.
Well, it depends how you look at it. If you look at it from the perspective of anything that's running on your phone is a consumer,
even if
this consumer was actually given to you by the service provider. So, for example, if Twitter comes with an official cell phone app, if they build that on top of their API, then that app, even though it was provided by Twitter, is really a consumer that is talking to the service provider. And in that particular case, you will actually be using tokens and not using them as passwords.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm just sort of going down a conceptual path, but it seems like there's something there.
So my question for you, Alex, as we come out of that and hear about all this stuff, and you don't, both of us eager to see this kind of thing succeed, and open authentication for APIs and such. How did you hear about that? Because I hadn't heard about it. You originally brought it to me.
I can't remember specifically, but I subscribed to Chris's blog, and I think he'd mentioned it. Chris is on my Facebook network, and he joined some network on there that triggered me off. I had a look at that, and I think it's one of these kind of subliminal. Like, I hear about it in one or two different places. It sounded interesting, dug into it, looked really interesting, and had to have the guys on.
So now, that's, I think, our cool tip of the week for people. If you're looking for a web resource to check out, one of the things I noticed about your feed from your blog, Alex, is you put all of your links that you find interesting, your delicious links, they all end up in your feed for your blog, right?
Right.
So beyond people having to read about you buying an espresso maker and doing an ROI analysis on it, there's actually some interesting stuff in your blog in that you link out to people who are talking about interesting things.
Well, it's stuff that I want to bookmark, one, so there's value for me there, but I happen to share it on my RSS feed.
All right, so we're going to link to your blog and your feed so that people can check that out. This week's show's Cool Tip of the Week.
Marvelous.
And with that, thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next show.
And get your hair cut.